What stories lie dormant in the tools and textures that shape our routines? Items so familiar they've become invisible. The grain of a kitchen bench, the weight of a shopping trolley, the smooth glide of a pen across paper. Every object is the result of choices, challenges, and creativity woven through time. I'm Anthony Burke, and this is Extraordinary Everyday, our special weekly segment here on ABC Radio National's By Design. Humans have been tracking time for millennia, but when did we decide to strap the clock to ourselves? From ticking gears to tiny wristbound supercomputers, how has design transformed this glorified time-telling bracelet into the indispensable gadget we can't stop glancing at? Tanya Edwards is a horologist and co-founder of Collectability, a collecting consultancy, and is also a trustee emeritus of the Horological Society of New York. Tanya, thanks for joining me today. It's great to talk to you.
Pleasure. I love talking to somebody who is on the other side of the world in the sun. Not like here, where we're in minus 12 with over a metre of snow and I'm snowed into my home.
So let's start then with the history. I mean, the most obvious question is when were watches invented? And then when do we go from a pocket watch to a wrist watch?
From the 1300s, there would be a clock in a village or a town that would tell the time for everybody because that was all they could afford and it would usually be on the church tower steeple. And then it wasn't until the 1500s, but still really early, that the first portable timepieces were invented. Now, we wouldn't call those a pocket watch. We'd call them a small clock because that's basically what they were, a small clock. But they were ingenious little mechanical marvels that could tell the time in a very small size. And very, very wealthy people like Henry VIII, for example, would wear one on a big heavy chain around his neck. And that was a real testament of his wealth and his power that he could own something as magnificent as that. Then we move into the 1600s and decoration becomes very important. So things like enameling and really delicately decorating the surface of something small became very stylish, again, for the very privileged few. And so artisans would take a small, by then pocket watches were starting to come in. So we're talking about the 1600s, 1700s, that's when pocket watches started to be developed, but they would be very highly decorated and again, owned by aristocracy or royalty, just the privilege of the super rich. And then we get into the 1800s and pocket watches become more normal. They're not just the privilege of the super rich, but they are not readily available to most people. But it's when, I think, in the most interesting time for watchmaking, when some of the big brands that we still know today became really established and started creating smaller movements.
Yeah, and then at some time then around the 1800s, you're saying, we went from pocket watch to wristwatch. Is that correct?
I would say it was more the 1900s that we went to wristwatches. The earliest known Swiss wristwatch was made in 1868 for, again, a member of the aristocracy in this instance, a countess, Countess Kausowicz, who was a Polish countess. And she came up with a very novel idea of having a timepiece on her wrist as a piece of jewellery. Again, rather than a pendant or a brooch, she wanted something that looked like a bracelet, but was actually a watch. And it's very clever. It's a bangle. And it has a little movement on it and a beautiful diamond, a rose-cut diamond, a very large diamond, that's hiding the face of the little tiny timepiece that's inside it. And it wasn't really until the First World War when wristwatches became a necessity. There was a need for them. And that really was what changed everything. for a couple of important reasons. The first one is that it changed the way that people looked at time. Because when the First World War came along, suddenly timing became critical. Looking at artillery and infantry movements, all that kind of thing mattered for hundreds, if not thousands of people. And practically speaking, a pocket watch was not a useful tool because a pocket watch was held in a pocket, obviously, and it had to be taken out and it had to be looked at. And that critical time of fumbling around, looking for your pocket watch, taking it out, maybe it had a cover on it, you had to open it. In those few seconds, it was a matter of life and death, especially in trench warfare. And World War One, very sadly, was primarily about trench warfare. And going over the edge and to attacking the enemy, it was all about timing and you couldn't afford to look at your watch. And so when the First World War started, owning a timepiece, in this instance was a pocket watch, was the privilege of a few. It was a privilege mostly of the officer class. So these officers, what they would do is they'd take their pocket watch, they'd solder on some little legs onto each side, and they'd put a strap through, and they would literally tie it to their wrists so that it just saved them time to quickly look at the time. So from that moment on, our military realized that they needed to provide more than just officers with timing equipment, and that needed to be a watch. And that's really when companies like Timex, Hamilton, Waltham, they started making watches that were affordable. But it wasn't really until, I would say, the 1940s, 1950s, that people really started wearing wristwatches as we know them.
Yeah, right.
So I think people are quite surprised to know that because it's more recent in a way than people think. And it wasn't really until the quartz crisis, which we call it the crisis in the mechanical watch.
Oh, this sounds very dramatic, please.
Yes.
The quartz crisis.
But it wasn't really a crisis as such because quartz technology introduced much, much cheaper watches that cost a fraction of a mechanical timepiece. And quartz in timekeeping is really an energy supply. So before quartz was invented, which is literally a little tiny battery type thing, all our batteries are run off quartz, for example, timepieces were mechanical. So they had a movement in them that would be wound up and that winding would put the energy into the watch and that would gradually wind down. So along comes quartz and it meant you didn't have to wind your watch every day. And it just meant another thing that was very practical was that it was completely accurate because you didn't have to rely on a mechanical movement. And it's much cheaper and quicker and easier to make a quartz timepiece than it is to make a mechanical timepiece.
So there are a lot of changes then going along in the history here. What is the biggest change you think in this history of watches? The biggest and most perhaps interesting and maybe unexpected sidebar as the watch evolves here?
I think without question, and I hate to say this, but it was the quartz revolution. But, you know, today we're seeing another change again, which is, of course, the smartwatch. And that's another change that arguably is a revolution because we didn't have smartwatches until somewhat recently. We didn't know we could answer our phone on our wrist or know how far we'd walked or what our heartbeat was doing or how many hours sleep we had. But that's brought back wearing something on our wrist that is utilitarian and gives us information that we want.
When you were the vice president at Patek Philippe, you championed a phrase, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that you never truly own a watch, you just look after it for the next generation. That's a beautiful idea. Why do you think that was so provocative and so powerful as a message around wristwatches?
Because I think that valuable mechanical watches have a value beyond money, beyond the actual cost. They have an emotional value. And when the ad agency that came up with that brilliant tagline were doing their research, they found that the one thing that everybody had in common, a Patek Philippe owner had in common, was that their wristwatch was the most important thing they owned, and they were going to give it to a child because it represented them, that they hoped that their child would have seen them wear that watch every day and remembered them for that.
Yeah. So really from fashion to function and then now to this sort of longer term, eternal, emotional connection with something bigger than ourselves. That's what the wristwatch represents. What a beautiful thing to locate in such a small...
tiny little thing.
A small mechanism, yeah. A tiny little thing. Wonderful. Tanya, it's been so lovely talking to you. It's such a beautiful history. And the way you've described it, I'm so jealous of the work that you do. You must have seen the most amazing things.
Oh, I feel very privileged. Thank you. Yes, very privileged.
Well, thanks for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Tanya Edwards, co-founder of Collectability. What other everyday object might have a story hiding in plain sight? If there's something you'd like us to explore, I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line at bydesign@abc.net.au. That's bydesign@abc.net.au. Thanks for the great suggestions so far, which include the clothes peg and louver windows. Thank you, Ruth. And Louise would like to hear about the invention of the mirror. Me too. Great ideas. Thanks for sending them our way. Remember to follow the show on ABC Listen. Just search for Anthony Burke's By Design. And if you're tuning in elsewhere, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It's the best way to help others discover the show. You've been listening to ABC Radio National's By Design because in a rapidly changing world, design matters.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.